TSIA strongly believes that AI is not just changing the workflows within technology companies. AI is changing the business model of technology companies. Yet, there is very little discussion about this evolving reality. TSIA is committed to changing that. I'm Thomas Long, the executive director of TSIA. Welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And today I'm going to be joined by Satya Gunampally, who is the CEO and founder of G5 Infotech. And it's a consulting firm that helps companies realize value from investing in AI. And we're going to be discussing the future of technology services and the future of the AI solution marketplace, and also the future of tech business models. So let's get the insight engine humming. Satya, welcome. It's nice to see you again. We've met before. Welcome to Tectonic. Exactly when did you start the company you're at right now, and what was the catalyst for starting this company?
First of all, thank you, Thomas, for having me on this podcast. Right around the end of 2022, we started the company, G5 Infotech, and we were exploring basically digital transformation and cloud technologies at the time. And then when ChatGPT moment came around towards the end of 2022, it was pretty clear that AI technologies and all the models that are coming out at the time is going to foundationally shift everything in, not only in IT, but everything, right? You know, Every business is going to be impacted because this is such a foundational shift, which is described by some people as invention of electricity itself or the steam engines, industrial revolution. It's going to be much bigger than that. So we pivoted into the AI advisory and consulting practice, and primarily looking at trying to transform small and mid-sized companies to use these AI technologies to redesign their workflows, reinvent their workflows, and think about AI at the core of everything rather than trying to bolt it at the edges. You know, that is the promise of that. Yeah.
And as you said, you're helping companies, so small to mid-size, really embed AI in the way that they're operating, full stop. And I want to start with sort of your assessment of the state of AI deployment in the enterprise. You know, what are some of the biggest, because you're trying to help these companies effectively adopt it, what are some of the biggest struggles you're seeing that they face when they start this journey?
So fundamentally, whenever any major transition has to happen, right, there is always that resistance from the people. So culture, you know, culture of the people and how all your employees are willing to actually take some risks, take some new learnings, right, you know, and put them into practice. Because as human beings, we tend to revolve around our routines, right? You know, we tend to go back to our way of, old way of doing it all the time. And even when people learn about the capabilities of these models and ChatGPTs and Geminis and all the video models, everything, we always tend to think in terms of, oh, I used to do this way, you know, and then you just navigate into that particular path. So pausing a little bit and thinking about how do we actually take these capabilities and rethink about everything, right, you know, and that requires some investment of time. So the major corporations that are actually successful are the ones where the leadership is actually learning these technologies and taking advantage of them in their own day-to-day life, in their own workflows, and are able to push it down. And at the same time, organizations that are able to enable, you know, have a center of excellence, whether it is two or three people, a small center of excellence within their own company. And that is helping rest of the employees start seeing the value and find some of these AI champions early, detect them, and enable those people to start propagating some of the success stories. Those are the people that are able to successfully do that. In terms of mid-sized companies, one of the other challenges is data readiness, right? You know, the data is siloed across so many different places. And trying to put together all the data sources to build the right context for the models is very important. Without the context, the models are, these are very smart models, but they got the world knowledge, right? The entire world knowledge is there, unless until you specify, like, you know, what is your intent, what is the context you are coming out with, the models are going to be as helpful. So bringing all the data sources together to build the right context to provide to the model is also a challenge. But new technologies like MCP and everything are coming out that are helping in this regard.
So an important thing you said is what you're observing is that leadership teams have to lean into the technology. They have to experiment with it themselves. They have to start to get comfortable with it. And that starts to create a culture and an environment top down of, hey, this is something that is important to us. And then combine that with the center of excellence, if you will. I think that coaching is spot on, especially for smaller and mid-sized companies. One question that I ask every TSI member, regardless of size, if I'm talking to them, I say, where are you on AI? What are you doing? And I literally, end of last week, I was in a conversation with a member and the response was, well, we're not really doing anything. Our leadership team's not too aware. They're really kind of nowhere on it. And, this recent report that came out from MIT saying that, 95% of enterprise AI use cases, there's no ROI. I think that's a very unfortunate report because I think it sends this false negative that, hey, a lot of people are failing. There's no there. And if you're a management team like the one I was talking to last week, who's doing nothing on this, then it gives you this false sense that, oh, I guess that's fine because it's still really early days. And nobody's really getting an ROI. And I have to tell you, I think that is absolutely the wrong strategy. I am sure that you are seeing lots of use cases that are playing out. So I'm just curious, do you still bump into management teams who kind of have their arms crossed on this and you have to do convincing, or what's your experience out there in the wild right now?
Yeah, leadership actually seems to understand because there's a lot of talk, right? There's a lot of conversations coming out of all the Silicon Valley companies and the valuations. They pay attention to what is happening into the stock market, $4 trillion companies and Larry Ellison getting $100 billion in a single day, So they pay attention to those things. So at least they're aware of that AI wave is coming. Even if you look at some of the early startups, right, that have been valued at $3 billion to $10 billion range, they are not only seeing their valuations go up, they are also seeing their revenue is jumping. For example, Mercor, the company that is helping with automating hiring, AI, as well as trying to make a perfect match of employees' requirements as well as the employees' skill set, it went from $1 million to $500 million revenue in about 18 months.
Wow.
Yeah. They are measuring their revenue growth not by year, month by month. They are actually saying week by week, week by week, they're growing at 18%. So when you find out the right use case as well as the right implementation, sky is the limit because these models are becoming extremely intelligent, the IQ level of 140 right now. And next year, they're already talking about closer to 200, way beyond most human beings. So this 94-95% failure rate, I think there was a lot of discussion on this on the LinkedIn, and some people are like, hey, it's the same thing when you start to look at Y Combinator startups, right? These are very bright kids. But when you try to find the market fit, typically 5% of the companies actually make it after the first round, right? Once they finish their Y Combinator 3-month program, and rest of them don't get funded, right? And it's not like people haven't implemented it correctly or anything like that. Sometimes finding that right market fit is always the problem, right? So within the enterprises, I think the advice we tell people is start small, find something that low-hanging fruits that are easy to implement, let the rest of the employees start using those things, whether it is a simple chatbot or a deep research tool. That we all struggle in the companies to find the right information all the time, right? There's so many Slack messages, Teams messages going around saying that, hey, where is that particular document or where is that particular information, right? Just getting that right information right at the time that you are making a decision or trying to use is quite helpful, right? And then they can slowly navigate into AI agents and AI teammates, and vendors are also creating a lot of good products. So every company doesn't have to create these things from scratch.
Yeah. So I want to build on something you said there. I think it's an interesting lens in terms of this quote, 95% failure rate. You're saying, look, in the world of startups, if people have ideas about use cases, most of them fail before you have a successful use case. So this 95% quote failure rate should not be a surprise in a world where we're early days and we're experimenting with the right use cases. So that's one observation you made. I think to build on that, I would say that, and I don't know, with our members and watching them experiment with use cases, I think that their success rate is higher than 5%. That's my experience watching companies operate. But let's just say it's still half the cases fail. I don't care. I think part of it with AI also is a technology where you can fail fast. This isn't like deploying a massive enterprise-wide software system where you spend 2 years deploying and then all of a sudden you find out, oh, it's a poor fit or we didn't get... It's not like that. These use cases, you can stand up very rapidly, see if you're getting return, right? See if there's impact. And if there's not, move on to the next one. And I'm curious if that's the same thing that you're seeing with your customers.
Absolutely. With all the vibe coding tools and everything, product managers and product owners are able to actually build a prototype within a few hours, right? In a week, overnight. And rapid iteration is what makes the difference, right? Elon Musk always says, your rate of improvement is basically how fast you can iterate, you know, and learn from that and keep improving it. And that's one of the reasons he's able to send the Starship up there, and he landed the rocket in 2016 first time. And since then, very few companies are able to accomplish what he has accomplished. And this is what is one of the force multiplier, right? And even the AI companies like OpenAI and Anthropic, Claude Code, when they released it, it wasn't a product that thought about it. They actually released it internally just to see how people are using it. And according to Dario, in the first week itself, 100 people started using that. And within a month, 500 people within the company were using it. And he said, hey, if we did not force on anybody. We just said, hey, this tool is available. If you want to use it, you can go ahead and use it. And when internally people are able to find use, that means this has some value in it. Let's release it externally, right? You know? Mm-hmm. And that became one of their very successful product. And it actually started the entire coding agents and all the, the coding is now probably 30% of the use cases that are actually making money right now, right? You know? So this rapid iteration is getting way better also, because these coding agents, recently I actually explored a small company called Blitzy. They are able to generate about 10 to 20 million lines of code. Mm-hmm. You know, they can take an entire legacy COBOL database, COBOL code, IBM, and all those things, and understand all the dependencies of the entire code base, because most of the companies don't have that expertise anymore. They left, they retired, you know. And AI is able to understand it, document it, and it is also able to refactor it into modern languages. So with that type of capability coming into the picture, rapid prototyping, rapid iteration is fairly easy for the companies. Throw it out there between your users, find the first 10 users, 100 users, see how they use it, and accordingly iterate it, you know. So the cost of failure is not that much.
The economics of enterprise tech are breaking. AI startups are threatening the domain of long-established enterprise technology providers. Yet, it is unclear exactly how technology providers will drive profitable revenue in the AI era. TSIA has always been focused on what it takes to have a profitable business model in enterprise tech. AI Economics is a body of actionable TSIA research that is digging into the future of tech business models. How will AI solutions be priced? What does the next generation tech services portfolio look like? And why does TSIA believe that it is not the end of tech services, but the era of services? Go to tsia.com/AI Economics to learn the answers. I actually want to backtrack. You put a company on the table here that's growing 18% a week. What was the name of that company again?
Mercor, M-E-R-C-O-R.
So here's a question. I'm just very curious your perspective on this. So one of my fellow researchers, George Humphrey, created this index for me. It's called the AI 20, and it's 20 publicly traded AI native companies, right? Ones that have gone public, they're out there. And I can tell you that the common profile here is that these companies are growing rapidly, maybe not 18% a week, but they're all growing rapidly. At the same time, on average, their operating incomes are negative 26% on average. If you look and click into a company like OpenAI, which is not public, but is, you know, clearly not a profitable company, right? Their business model, despite having the most popular application in the history of applications, not making money. So there's this really interesting phenomenon right now with these AI native startups where they're getting lots of investment, they're clearly growing quickly, but they're highly unprofitable, which we saw that in the SaaS world, that's okay. But also there's not a lot of debate, discussion, or thinking around the path to profitability. And this is something that I'm intellectually really curious right now. We're starting to really think of, you know, research in terms of these models. What is your sense on these AI startups? How do you think they become profitable? Have you ever chipped on that one?
Yeah. So US companies especially tend to have this attitude where growth is everything. You keep growing, keep growing, keep growing, and profitability will come later.
Don't worry about that.
Don't worry about that. And we have seen many companies fail, whenever that growth kind of stalls and they don't know how to make the money anymore, right?
That's right.
So there are two things that are working for OpenAI and other companies like Anthropic and everything is, as these models are getting better and better, at the same time, the cost of running these models is becoming cheaper and cheaper, right? We see that 10x improvement. And we see a trend with the small language models, which are like under 10 billion parameters, where you can combine many small language models with the agentic framework, right? Multiple agents debating, discussing. They can actually perform as good as very large language models, sometimes even better.
Mm-hmm.
So with that approach, their costs are going to come down. And at the same time, the usage patterns also will go up. So eventually, some companies will definitely make money. But one example is a smaller company, you probably are familiar with them, called Gamma, right? They give you this AI-generated slides and documents and everything. It's a 40-people company. They're already making around $50 million and cash flow positive already, right?
And I'm sorry, what's their use case?
Google Slides and PowerPoint, make the slides. They started with the slides and now they're creating additional AI-generated.
And so they're cash flow positive based on their subscriptions from their users.
Correct. Yeah. Another point for these startup companies is, if you look at all the AI startup companies, these people are actually using AI to do most of their work, right? From coding to documentation to getting sales and everything. So the number of people employed is very less,
Yeah, for sure.
10 people, 50 people. In fact, I was actually reading OpenAI CFO. She wrote a blog, I think she said, they're only operating with 18% within their finance division, 18% of the people comparative to the similar size company, that is just one-fifth of the people, right? It's amazing, right? 18 people, 100 people, because they're using all these AI tools internally to do that. So because of all that, I think profitability will come for many of these companies. But at the same time, if they keep spending a lot of money, there's always a danger that...
So I'm just going to play some of that back here. And again, we're not going to solve this or come up with the right answer here, but I think it's an interesting thing to start thinking about for the industry, because again, if you're these AI native companies, they have benefits in terms of less labor, for sure. That's going to help them, number one. And number two, what you're saying is they have economies of scale in terms of the cost of delivering their core service is going to go down. That's working in their favor. I would say what's working against them is the rapid commoditization of some of these services as well, right? And so, and just to give you a sense, I mean, SaaS companies, their gross margin, so their revenue minus the cost of the core service, their gross margin is about 70%. These native AI companies, the ones that are public, they're 50%, 55%, because again, so much more infrastructure costs. So I think it's going to be a really interesting evolution to see if somebody can get to scale. And I think the other big question, which is different, if you were Salesforce and you were growing at all costs because you wanted to dominate CRM and become the number one provider, whatever, that was a game being played. I don't know. In the world of AI, is there going to be one ring to rule them all? Is there going to be one model like an OpenAI who everybody goes to? I don't think so. It's already hyper competitive between Genesis and, Grok. Again, I'm bullish on AI. I think there's a lot of money being thrown at it. I think the path to profitability is crazy unclear, which leads to the next set of questions that I kind of want to get, chip on with you, because the reason I reached out to you is you posted a really interesting article on LinkedIn about the future of services. In your comment there, I think the title of the article was SaaS is Eating Services, How AI Agents Are Disrupting Traditional IT Consulting. And I agree with that. I mean, I think that AI is very disruptive to traditional services. So let's start out there in terms of just, do you feel that AI is going to eliminate just certain categories of technology services? Which ones do you think are most at risk from your perspective?
So right now, the entire BPO industry, right, business process outsourcing, call centers, and customer service, we're already seeing a lot of that customer support kind of things rapidly automated, right? can see, I think Salesforce already announced, Mark Benioff, that they were able to reduce their support
from 4,000.
Yeah, 4,000, like that, right? And yesterday I was actually talking to a friend. He said, I think I talked to an AI agent, but I'm not sure. So it is getting to that level, people can't even differentiate, right? You know?
Yeah.
But the fact that if the AI agent, you make a phone call to a company, and the person automatically, or AI agent that is talking to you, automatically knows about you and your recent history of transaction or whatever you are talking about, and start directly addressing it immediately, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you are like much more comfortable, and you can probably finish the call instead of 15 minutes in next 2 to 5 minutes, right? You know? So, and I was also looking at another small startup called Console, and they basically said vast majority of the requests that come to IT, no, reset my password, or I am not getting access to this particular document, or I need access to this. Those type of simple requests, they are already automating it at a 50% rate, and that will only keep going up, right, as they get learn more and more. And then the most surprising thing that happened in the last 1 year, right, the AI coding. I was actually listening to Greg Brockman on OpenAI when they released their Codex last week itself. In 2023, they expected the AI is able to generate about 1,000 lines of code. That will be great, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we went way past that, you know. 1,000 lines of code is like table stakes, right? So the rate of progress on that coding agent is surprising pretty much everybody in the industry. So people were thinking that the low-level programming, the early starter, you know, employees that are just starting out after their graduation would be impacted. But it looks like we are not going to actually even write the code anymore. People will come out with a system-level thinking, architectural thinking, and just wipe code everything, right? You know, if the AI is able to generate in overnight a few million lines of code, there is no way human beings can review that.
Mm-hmm.
So the entire peer review process is, OpenAI announced that 90% of their peer reviews are actually done by the AI right now. And not only peer reviews are done by AI, they're actually uncovering a lot of issues and everything that typical human beings misses, right?
Yeah.
Because it is going through so many vast knowledge base and figuring out and looking at every single thing, right? You know, even if I give an employee a 100-point checklist and say, you go through these 100 points and do the PR, nobody's going to do that, you know, because it's very tedious work and humans are not good at that. So coding is completely going to be disrupted. Nobody's going to write the code manually anymore. We all have to use these AI tools to get better and better. And then the next frontier is obviously the video generation and the content generation, the movie industry, the entertainment industry, the gaming, all those things are also coming into the picture, probably early next year, I would say. And one thing that is, people always thought we are actually better and AI will not be able to do ever is innovations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Coming out with the new ideas and everything. And even that is actually happening by some of these AI models. So nothing is off limits for this AI.
Yeah.
I think only way we can do better is by learning these AI tools and figuring out how we can actually get something done with the help of AI.
So I'm going to flip and look on the other side of the coin, but I do just want to comment on your clicking in to the coding example. And I was just listening to one of my favorite podcasts. I think it's called the Daily AI podcast. And his comment was the fact that, because this is, quote, the year of the agent, you know, an AI agents. And his comment was, clearly what to date has been proven is it's really AI agents for coding is being proving to be one of the most impactful use cases, which I think is really, you know, interesting. And to your point, I think people are getting amazed at how rapidly AI is working through that use case in terms of ability to code. So that, I mean, and in my world, you know, people in professional services who are doing coding and for testing and doing, you know, different things, I mean, that is going to be a game changer. But let's flip it over, because I mean, really what you put on the table is the fact that AI is eating through more and more complex use cases, more and more services, things that people do are going to be completely done by AI or heavily enabled by AI. What opportunities do you think AI creates from a service perspective? Where do you see companies have an opportunity to create, you know, new types of services working with customers?
That's actually an excellent question, because when I see the entire spectrum of startups, they're not trying to take an existing capability and trying to automate it. The vast majority of startups are actually providing new capabilities, right? Capabilities that were not there, or some human being had to spend a few days or a few weeks to do that kind of stuff. For example, deep research, right? Deep research takes about 5 to 10 minutes, and it's getting you to almost, some cases, 80 to 100% level, right? And if you really are doing it for the sake of just learning about particular market situation or particular technology, I use it almost on a daily basis. Anything that comes up, because it is doing entire web search, going through some hundreds of web pages, figuring out the right context, putting it all together. It's such a complex task for a human being to do that, you know, and that capability, we never had it, especially in under 10 minutes, right? So I think everybody should be thinking in terms of what are the new use cases it will enable, rather than just focusing on what are the things where we can just bolt it in, right? When you try to bolt it in, you tend to think in terms of, hey, I have this 10-step process, maybe I can use AI into this particular area, right? I mean, those use cases are also definitely valid. I'm not saying they're not valid. You can definitely do that. But the initial stage of making a lot of money or getting the user buy-in, when you enable a new capability, people will flock to you, right? You know, I think especially the one I just gave you, right, for AI slides, people have been struggling. Every time you want to make a 10 slides or 20 slides for a presentation, it takes a lot of time. You can use ChatGPT, but you still have to cut and paste, do all that kind of stuff, right? And then these AI tools are able to do that. It is able to get you to 50% to 70, 80% level, and all you are doing is editing it, right? You know, adding your value after that. So if you look at what Nano Banana did, right, you know, the Google.
Tell people what that is. I'm familiar with what it is, but explain to the audience what that is.
Sure. So Nano Banana is basically, you can describe it as image editing. But at the same time, it is not as simple as like Adobe Photoshop or anything like that. You could put in an image, and right now I'm looking at the camera, and Nano Banana can say, hey, can you change this particular image where I'm looking away from the camera, right? I'm looking opposite side of the camera, and it will figure out, you know, how the backside of me looks like. That is something that any image editor cannot do it today, right? That's one thing. And I can say like, hey, put together myself and Thomas walking down a park, right? You know, and you can take, and it is able to keep image consistency, facial expressions. It is automatically able to change your facial expressions also. Right, I upload my photo and say, hey, modify this image so I am laughing or I am surprised. So if you look at a lot of thumbnails on YouTube right now, people just do this. Oh, I'm surprised, you know. You know? And they are generating all that with the Nano Banana, right? You know.
And then that's a Google model, I believe, right? That's the Google released it. So this is a little bit of a rabbit hole, but I think it's interesting. Again, observation for the audience is because we were talking about new service opportunities, right? New use, and sometimes that's related to new use cases. And one thing with this particular Google model release, what they're observing, because, you know, like there's this huge spike in downloads, right? Of people downloading this particular model because it unlocked a whole new set of use cases like you were describing. Mm-hmm. And so I think the other thing with these AI tools is they keep evolving. They put things on the table, which just you just couldn't do before. It just was impossible to do or super hard to do. And now there's a new AI tool, and it's just like, wow, that's something that's practical for us to do, which I think is super interesting. Every Tectonic listener is well aware I am a big believer that AI is a game changer for how professionals in the technology industry will do their jobs. TSI Research is not immune to that reality. I am proud to say that we have been aggressively experimenting on how AI can change the way we create research and deliver those research insights to our members. And now we are ready to release TSIA Intelligence, the first Gen AI model designed exclusively for technology services. Unlike generic Gen AI tools, TSIA Intelligence taps into our real-world, industry-validated data that is not in the public domain. We have designed this model to give you clear, actionable, and board-ready insights. Right now, in technology services, the stakes are really high. Every decision counts. Good decisions can build your career. Bad ones can end it. General LLMs are incredibly powerful, but you need specialized insights built on industry data that you can trust. That is TSI Intelligence. To check it out, visit tsi.com/intelligence. So I want to shift gears here, because when you and I, last time we talked, we had this really interesting conversation about OpenAI and their investment in consulting as a potential mechanism to build industrial AI solutions that can be deployed at scale. You know, I am curious what you think, because, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about your background here is I can tell you're watching a lot of these startups. You're looking at a whole spectrum of how, you know, these AI providers are unfolding. And looking at, let's say, 5 years, who do you think will be the dominant providers of what I'll call enterprise class AI applications? Because that could be the hyperscalers like AWS or Microsoft. It could be niche vertical industry specialists who come in and say, I'm going to really understand healthcare and I'll use models, you know, like Gemini and OpenAI underneath that. Or it could be the model providers, right? That basically say you're OpenAI and you say, I'm going to build consultative and service capabilities on top of my model to deliver really enterprise class applications. So what is your perspective on this evolving landscape?
So the thrown number is by 2030, it is going to be about $1 trillion, right? Revenues from all these companies. Mm-hmm. I think 80% of that is going to be captured by NVIDIA's and infrastructure providers like hyperscalers. Yeah. And
Oracle. That's why Oracle's stock price is up massively, because they have this backlog of infrastructure deals. Yep.
Exactly, right. And then you mentioned before that, right, there's so many models are going to be there. They pretty much all do about the same level, right, you know, and for vast majority of the use cases, like 90%, even a smallish model can actually rewrite your email, summarize it, and do all kinds of stuff like that. So there's not a lot of money to be made at the model level itself. And that's one of the reasons, if you look at actually what OpenAI did in the last 2 months, they reorganized it. They bought in another CEO for Applied AI, right? I think her name is Fidzi. She came from Instacart and she was at Facebook before, I believe. And they're slowly buying all the companies that are going to enable them to get into more and more of the application spaces, right? And that's one thing. And they are also going after companies that are willing to spend about $10 million plus
for consulting type services to come in.
Services. And that is because the prediction is in the consulting world, eventually 80% of the work will be done by AI and 20% by human beings. Right? Mm-hmm. And when you have such an equation, whoever is able to provide those good AI agents to do all your architectures, maybe, or finding the requirements, like even this conversation, right? When you record this conversation, and which we can provide it to an AI and say, hey, summarize this and tell me even the personality of the people speaking, AI is able to do a pretty good job of that, you know? Mm-hmm. So companies who have that expertise, which obviously OpenAI has, they can provide these same services much faster and much cheaper also, because AI is doing vast majority of it. So the traditional consulting companies that are charging by the hour, by FTE, right, they will be at a major disadvantage unless they can actually figure out a business model that they can slowly start transitioning themselves, right, which is very hard for the incumbent. So all the Accentures, Deloitte's, they're all like struggling right now. And even like if you look at Gartner this year especially, right, their stock is down 50%. You know, and they're supposed to be advising all these clients about how to transform their company with AI, and they're not able to do themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, and that's the same case with TCS, Wipro, Infosys, all these companies. So fundamentally, everything is shifting, and it is going to be outcome-based pricing also, because companies don't want to pay for hours. And then after 6 months, 1 year, realize that it's not giving them the right result, right? Mm-hmm. So the business models have to evolve. They have to take advantage of all these capabilities AI is providing it. So the companies that are actually starting out fresh, the new companies, they are going to be at an advantage because they're starting from the green field. They can redesign their business models around these outcomes, which is, I think, Sierra did, AI is already doing it. They are primarily in the customer service with the voice. And what they are telling their customer is, we don't charge you if at all our AI is not able to resolve the customer issue, right? If it gets redirected to a human being, that is on us.
Yep. You know?
So we will charge only for the successful outcomes, which basically aligns the interest of your vendor with yours, right?
So I'm going to place some of that back because, I mean, so here's the things that research we're doing in TSA, we believe strongly at this point. So one is the fact that, you know, the money's going to be made by climbing up, you know, beyond the model and having as you just said, more outcome-oriented solutions where you can really help a customer unlock that outcome. That's number one. And number two, services are going to be involved in that. So again, like you mentioned, OpenAI is out there looking for $10 million consulting projects. They're looking capabilities they can acquire to deliver that kind of value proposition. So we think services is a big, important part of the answer. Also, you put on the table different types of services. A lot of the services are going to be incredibly technology enabled. It's not like the old days where it was all a whole room full of consultants or a busload of people had to show up to. It's not going to be like that. But you're going to have a service capability. One of the question marks, though, that I think is, as this whole thing unfolds, is on one end, as you mentioned, you have these startups or these, these companies that are coming with a fresh, clean slate, like an OpenAI, native startups, who are saying, well, I want to build that story, right? That outcome-oriented solution story. You also have legacy companies that are there, and we'll pick on something like a Salesforce in the sales and marketing space. They are not, that's not a clean slate, but they are a force to be reckoned with because they already have service organizations. Now, maybe different type of skills, et cetera, have to be there, but they don't have to go build that from scratch. They have that, right? They have account teams. They have presence in all the Fortune 500 companies. So we predict this battle royale between these new entrants that are going to want to climb up the value stack and these incumbents who already have these customer relationships and maybe don't have the net new technology, but can they be the vehicles to deliver that? I think who wins there is not predetermined yet. I think that that's what people are going to be fighting for, that ground here in the next 3 to 5 years. I think it's going to be super interesting to watch.
Absolutely. Actually, if you take an example of Thomson Reuters, right? They got this vast data sets that they were able to actually buy recently another AI startup that was working on the solution for the lawyers, right? Combine the value that they already have, the entire data sets and the data, they're sitting on a gold mine of data, and combine with this AI. So what will happen at some point, they will obviously buy some of these company that are building the capabilities. But again, the AI game is played by three things, right? Who has the compute for certain level? Yeah. And then who has the data? Data is the most important thing out here, right? So companies like TurboTax, companies like Bloomberg, who are all sitting on vast amount of data, they are going to be successful because that data, they are not going to just give it away for free.
That's right.
It's already locked up in their vaults. It's not on the internet. And most likely, even if there is a startup that is trying to encroach into their field, they'll most likely buy them out at some point,
Yeah, it's going to be super interesting. So I'm watching the clock here. I'm going to wind it down. I just wanted to comment for the audience. The first time you and I talked, you unlocked two AI use cases for me that I had not stumbled on before. And I just want to play them for the audience. So one of them, you mentioned this earlier in our conversation, is the fact that you can have a conversation with folks. If you have a transcript or whatever available, you can use AI to help assess the personalities of the people on that call, which is something I never thought about. And so for anybody out there in a sales role, a customer-facing role, maybe you have new players, you met new, important person at the customer, and they're in this conversation, using it to get some insights and analysis on that person's personality, what is important to them. I mean, that is a really interesting AI use case. So thank you for sharing that one. I don't know, how did you stumble on that one, by the way?
So I actually started the Google Recorder app I use all the time, right? When I'm walking or I'm thinking about something, I record it and then use AI, take the transcript and rewrite it into either a story or a blog or whatever it may be, right? Speed up the process a lot. I talked to a CEO and obviously with his permission, I recorded everything, right? And we were exploring the AI use cases and how they can start applying it within the company. And the next day I was thinking about, I should probably ask him about some feedback for me, right? How I did it and how I improve it and all, right? And then at the same time, I was thinking, he's a very busy guy and he won't be able to spend as much time with me. And or he might say, okay, a little couple of sentences, right? Then that night I was like, hey, I already have the transcript. I already had given to Claude at the time because of the context length was fairly high on that. And I take in the summarization, key action items, everything. And immediately it occurred, hey, why don't I just ask the AI itself, right? So I went back to the conversation and I just said, hey, tell me personalities of these people in this conversation. And it was able to identify absolutely what my role was, what the CEO's role was, everything. And it even knew the names because we were talking by each other. It was a two-way conversation. And then I said, give the feedback for Satya, myself. And it gave me two-page feedback, section by section, right? You know?
Wow.
So even if I had an executive coach sitting on the call, he probably wouldn't be able to do such a good job because they don't take notes of everything. They don't listen to everything, right? You know?
Yeah.
But AI doesn't have that problem. So that's then I experimented with a few of the students I was working with in the internship. And even with about a minute of everybody introducing each other, it was able to guess their personality.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing.
So these are the kind of things that I think what I noticed is even the people who are using AI for the last 2-3 years a lot, we still stumble upon these use cases.
Yes. Yes. That's why I wanted to share it. And the other one I want to share with folks that you opened my eyes to was you were talking about how if you're working on something, you can ask AI's advice, but say, well, how would Steve Jobs think about this? Or how would, right? And so you can bring in a big brain personality, like they're in the room to iterate with you. And I took that use case and I used it. I was working on a paper and a presentation version of that paper. And I said, how would Steve Jobs write this paper? Or how would Steve Jobs present this concept in a 20-minute presentation just to get that different perspective compared to Maslow? I mean, that is wicked cool. So it's just a way to be creative. So again, thank you. I appreciate you sharing that one as well. And I think, again, the lesson there is these use cases just keep evolving. And even if you're using AI, you know, quite a bit for a couple of years, there are these new ways you didn't even think about that are really helpful. And again, especially for creative people, I think super helpful. So anyway.
One thing I would say is I usually watch a podcast from Peter Diamandis, and there are like 4 people talking all the time, right? Yes. And as the podcast comes out, and I cannot ask any questions. So what I did was now actually Gemini models and ChatGPT, they can even take a 2 hours of YouTube video and they can understand it in a few seconds. So I said like, hey, take this podcast and write about what are the discussing section by section, because it's a 2-hour podcast and they go through multiple topics, right? And it understands where exactly each topic they are discussing about. And then I said at each section, right, ask some very intelligent question, create some intelligent question and tell me why it is a good question to ask. And it was able to create some wonderful questions and explain why that question is important. Because normally when I'm watching a podcast, because I don't have the ability to ask a question, I am very passive at the time, right? Not really like thinking about asking a question. So I sent them this particular use case and I said, why don't you have somebody recording that as you are going through the podcast and let AI ask this question, because these questions are actually very smart. A lot of times it is actually the art of asking question is also very difficult, right? You know?
Yes, for sure.
So that is another use case actually. Yeah. People probably will stumble upon and start using it at some point.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. Well, hey, thanks for stopping into Tectonic. Appreciate you sharing your insights. Again, I think you got your finger on the pulse of a lot of stuff that's going on and in the rapidly evolving AI world. And, you know, I always end these with a question of the day. And for our audience, you know, as you listen to this conversation, the competitive landscape is changing, capabilities are changing. The question that I have for you is, has your business model been AI proofed? Cheers, everybody. One of the main reasons we founded TSIA almost 20 years ago was to establish accurate operational benchmarks for technology service businesses that just didn't exist anywhere. Benchmarking is a killer tool to quickly understand your strengths and weaknesses. Benchmarking sets you on a journey that starts with where you are, points to what is possible, and identifies the business practices that will get you there. That's why I am super excited we decided to offer a free version of TSI's industry-leading benchmarks with Performance Optimizer. Performance Optimizer is an easy-to-use benchmarking tool you can access from the TSI website. You can assess operational strengths and weaknesses in multiple areas like customer success, professional services, support services, etc. And the Optimizer results prescribe specific actions to address specific challenges and opportunities. This is an amazing offer, and I am so proud we are doing this for all of our loyal Tectonic listeners who may not be corporate TSIA members. To check it out, visit tsia.com/free.